From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. In back-to-back votes, the Senate delivered an unusual rebuke to President Trump. The Senate yesterday called on the U.S. to end military support for Saudi Arabia for its war in Yemen, and also placed blame for the death of journalist Jamal Khashoggi squarely on Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Joining us now is Senator Tim Kaine, Democrat from Virginia. Senator, welcome. And why did you vote for these two resolutions? What do you think they're going to accomplish?
Well, the first resolution had a double purpose. It was to use the War Powers Resolution to reassert that Congress should have authority over when we're at war and when administrations, and this has been true of presidents of both parties and Congresses of both parties, start to feel like they can engage in war without Congress, you wreck the constitutional value of having this debate before the public, before you commit our men and women, our troops, into harm's way. So we're starting to haul that power back, and the strong vote in Congress against this undeclared war in Yemen, I think, was very powerful. The second message from that resolution, though, was a strong message to the Saudis. They have been acting with impunity, whether it's the kidnapping of the Lebanese prime minister, the blockade of Qatar, the horrible mismanaged prosecution of the war in Yemen. But then there was a last straw, which was their state-sponsored murder of Virginia resident journalist Jamal Khashoggi, who had been advocating against the war in Yemen. And the Saudi government clearly felt like they could do that and get away with it, and nobody would trouble them. And they just need to know that in the halls of Congress, they don't have a free pass on something like this.
But aren't these resolutions largely symbolic, because the House is not likely to pass or even consider either of them? And the president has said maybe the Saudi crown prince did order the killing. Maybe he didn't. He certainly publicly does not believe that Mohammed bin Salman is responsible.
There is a symbolic element to them, Jeremy. You're right. Speaker Ryan, in his last act of public service, I guess, has decided that he wants to kill these resolutions. And so between now and the end of the year, they won't move. But there's going to be a Democratic House next year. I view this as more as a clear first step in a process of both taking back war-making power to Congress, giving a message to the Saudis, but also showing President Trump. And I think Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi showed him this week in the meeting in the Oval Office. For his first 2 years, he's been surrounded by a lot of enablers, the congressional leadership, his own cabinet. He can spout off things that aren't true, and he'll have people nodding and smiling and saying yes to his faith. Those days are coming to an end. On January 3, when there is a Democratic House, he'll have to get used to dealing with people who aren't enablers but are going to be a true Article 1 branch. We're not Article 2.5 and play Mother May I with the president. We have our own independent role to play in American government. I think the president's going to have to get used to that new reality.
Do you think that it's possible that because of the pressure from the Senate, that perhaps Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman will be removed from his position of power, and that the Saudis will say, okay, fine, we're going to put somebody else in charge?
Jeremy, I have a real strong feeling about this. I don't tell other nations who their leaders should be. That's for them to decide. But when behavior is past the point of being tolerable, we have to stand up for human rights, for journalism, for the notion that a consulate should be a safe haven. We have to stand against humanitarian disasters that are being created by this war in Yemen. We stand up for our values, and then countries can make their own adjustments. But I will say this: I do think the strong Senate action has already produced some response. You saw the beginnings of some positive breakthroughs in the discussions about trying to reach a ceasefire and an ultimate political settlement to the civil war in Yemen. And I believe that the strong message we're sending, that we're just not going to plant our feet on the Saudi side and go along with them whatever they do, I think that's probably important to trying to find a resolution to this grim humanitarian disaster.
One more thing, Tim Kaine, you were obviously the vice presidential nominee in 2016, and as you look forward, do you think that Beto O'Rourke is the leader of the pack right now for 2020 for the Democrats?
I think it's too early to say who's the leader of the pack. The good news is we've got a lot of really dynamic candidates, and I'm excited to see the number of young and diverse candidates. I think that is a really good thing. I suspect it's going to be kind of a messy and challenging process for a while just because of the sheer number of candidates. But having a young and dynamic field and a lot of people who are interested in carrying the banner for the party is nothing but good news.
That is Senator Tim Kaine, Democrat from Virginia. Senator, thank you.
Okay, thanks much, Jeremy.
Tomorrow is the final day of open enrollment for health insurance coverage through the Affordable Care Act marketplaces, and Democrats are blitzing social media to encourage people to sign up, including former President Barack Obama.
I think you've proven that you don't need to see me taking jump shots or sitting between a couple of forest plants in order to know it's important to have health insurance in case, God forbid, you get really sick or hurt yourself next year. So this year, I'm giving it to you straight. Sign up for health insurance at healthcare.gov before the deadline on December 15th.
Let's talk about this and other stories sizzling on social media this week with Femi Okey. She's host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Femi, good to have you back.
Nice to be back. Hello, Peter.
Hello. So along with this message from a former president who has a lot on the line because the Affordable Care Act is his legacy, a lot of heavy hitters in Democratic politics are taking this to social media. What are you seeing?
I'm seeing Bernie Sanders, Nancy Pelosi, Elizabeth Warren. The Senate Democrats have a little gift going out saying you have until December the 15th to sign up. All of these postings on various social media platforms are also encouraging debate about affordable health care. Dustin, for instance, says to Senator Warren, I would love to sign up, but I'm 33. I decided to go back to school to be part of the solution as a medical provider. Meanwhile, my monthly premium is 45% of my part-time income. And even as a disabled veteran, I cannot afford that. Huh. So the whole debate about healthcare, is it affordable? Who can afford it? All coming up because of this slump in the sign-up for healthcare.gov. And that deadline comes up on Saturday. But it's not just Democrats who are actually encouraging people to sign up. The Secretary Alex Azar is also saying, and he's the Health and Human Services Secretary, he's also saying if health.gov is right for you, then you should sign up as well. But his tweet and his YouTube platform where he's actually giving the message out, very plain, very basic. So while President Obama has thousands and thousands of retweets and likes saying you need to sign up, the last tweet that I saw from the Health and Human Services Secretary, he had about 7 retweets and 12 likes.
Wow.
And the deadline is Saturday. So it may well be the packaging and the urgency because there are actually now more options, cheaper options, a range of options than there were even a year ago.
Well, and the reason some of these Democrats might be doing this is because the Trump administration has cut back on its advertising budget so much that people, a lot of people don't know that that deadline is coming. I want to talk to you about a video editor for The Washington Post who has complained that social media sites continued targeting her with baby-related ads after her baby was stillborn. She's making the point that these companies knew she was pregnant. They should also know that her baby died and they should adjust accordingly. What are you seeing there?
Well, these are all the ads that, you know, whenever we're on social platforms, we're looking for something, we're doing a little bit of shopping, and they suddenly decide that not only do you want one pair of boots, you might want 20 other pairs of boots as well. So you can think about what that might mean if you're looking for gifts and items for your baby. So Gillian Brockwell, who lost her baby was stillborn, said, of course, I shared information on Facebook with my friends. I used hashtag 30 weeks pregnant, hashtag baby bump. But when I wanted those ads to stop because my baby died, I couldn't get them to stop. And so many people responded to her open letters that she sent to Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and at Experian. All of them. She shared this awful experience that she had and got so much feedback back to her as well.
I think it's also a chance for us to just to rethink of how much of our personal lives we put on social media, too.
It's all there. And I have to just say, just to his credit, that Facebook actually responded. The VP of advertising to Facebook said, I'm so sorry for your loss. We're working on better algorithms so we can stop that. You can adjust your settings so you don't have anything to do with parenting, but it's not a perfect science. And what was really nice about this story, if there was a nice takeaway, was that computer scientists, data scientists said, oh, we are so sorry this happened to you, Gillian, and to other parents and families who've lost ones, and they keep being bombarded by ads. We need to do better. We will try to do better.
Okay, we just have about a minute left, but I want to ask you about this story. The Rolling Stone reported details of how Taylor Swift used facial recognition software to scan the faces of her fans at a concert in Southern California to protect her from her stalkers.
So here's apparently how it worked, Peter. This is being reported by Rolling Stone, is that concert goers, as they were filing in, were looking at video of Taylor Swift, but that was software scanning their faces that then went back to a post in Nashville, Tennessee, to compare those faces with known stalkers of Taylor Swift.
And there are a lot of them, by the way.
Absolutely. And she hasn't come out to say anything in particular right now. She hasn't denied it. She hasn't said, yes, I'm doing it. But that is the idea of how the science was working. People were very concerned about privacy and whether this should even be allowed to happen without your consent.
Sure. Definitely worth having a conversation about that. Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Thanks as always.
You're welcome, Peter.
We've been talking this week about young adults and money. The average millennial with debt is about $36,000 in the red and spends about a third of their monthly income paying it off. Personal finance expert Lynette Calfani-Cox says lessons about money should start at home.
I often find parents, you know, they kind of say, geez, who am I to tell my kid what to do financially? I kind of made a mess of things. And what I'll share with them is that actually that's instructive, because you have a life lesson and you can convey that information to your young adult child and help him or her avoid that same pitfall.
So we're going to hear now from two young adults who got two very different lessons about money growing up. First, Sam Giangrasso. She's 25 years old, an elementary school teacher in the Boston area who is coming to terms with debt in her life. Sam, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So how bad is it?
It's bad. And it didn't seem bad initially. So the
Can you give me a number?
Oh, a number?
Yeah.
$72,000.
How did that happen?
Well, I did my undergrad at Lesley, and I didn't really have any experience or any really make any of the decisions about taking out my loans and financing my undergrad career. I did luckily have some money inherited that went to it, but most of my undergrad was paid for with loans.
So nobody ever sat you down and said, Sam, you're going to college, it's expensive, be careful.
No. I will say, though, I was raised by my grandparents and not by my parents. And I wonder if I was raised from someone from a younger generation, if we would have had a conversation about this. But my grandmother, when I started college, it was basically like, yeah, you're going to college. Don't worry.
She
like,
was
it's
proud
taken
of you.
Care of. Yes. Yeah. And it was more like no conversations were had anywhere, really, about managing my money in college or having money outside of college or managing debt.
So when you were younger, you didn't have these conversations with your grandparents. Was that something that you knew was missing from your life, or was it this huge rude awakening once you reached adulthood and you got a bill in the mail that said you owe $72,000?
Well, it wasn't a huge rude awakening initially right out of college, because I started my master's pretty soon after.
And so, went deeper in debt.
And thought it was great because I could defer my loans. And then I'm like, yeah, I don't have to pay anything ever. And like, oh, and by the way, here's a credit card.
Yeah. Was money taboo at the time? I mean, why didn't your grandparents talk to you about it?
I really don't know why. I actually was recently talking to my grandmother about this, and I didn't ask her why she never talked to me about it, but I was pretty upset. I was like, this feels out of my control. It feels like I'm spiraling. I don't know what to do. I don't even know how to begin to tackle this. And it was basically like, I've had those problems my whole life. Mm. So I feel like a lot of people think that debt is kind of inevitable. Everyone has it, and somehow we're supposed to be okay with it.
Mm.
That was something I found out the hard way. And I also kind of compared myself to lots of other people my age, a lot of going out frequently and taking these trips and doing all these great things. And I thought that I should be keeping up with that. So that also, I kind of racked up a lot of credit card debt trying to keep up with everyone else too.
How much?
$7,000.
on top of what you owe.
On top of my current student loans, yeah.
Look, you're clearly aware of the problem now.
Yes.
I'm sure you're doing things to solve the problem. And I know you're a fan of Dave Ramsey.
Yes. Right. Not everything, but a lot of what he discusses.
This is the, for people who don't know, a personal finance guru who has his own radio show. And I want to play some tape from Dave Ramsey. Here is a caller who was a doctor asking what to do about $670,000 in debt that he and his wife have racked up in student loans. And here's what Dave Ramsey said.
But yeah, you need to live on nothing and pay everything above nothing towards this disaster. You need to be in panic mode, dude. I mean, I can't breathe, and it's not even my debt. $670,000 worth of debt? And you're just nonchalant about it. I want you operating on me.
So those are doctors, presumably very smart people. Mm-hmm. You seem like a very smart person.
Thank you.
And yet you and many other smart people have gotten into this kind of problem. Does that make you feel at least any better that you have some company out there in the world?
It really does. It makes me feel better. And it also, I need to put this out in the open. I regret it now when I look at the bill. But I also think that because I took out that loan, I have my life now. But yes, it does feel like a very big problem now in my adult life.
And what are you doing to fix it?
I've started budgeting, like really budgeting. And on top of teaching, I'm babysitting outside of teaching. So there are some days
You've got a side hustle.
Oh, yeah. Which is tiring. And I think of people who have kids or who have other people to be responsible for. And that's a really scary thing. And I want to get it taken care of before I have to take care of anyone else eventually.
Good for you. I mean,
thank you.
You're making the best of a tough situation. Sam Giangrasso, thanks so much.
Thanks.
Okay, now another perspective from a young woman who is debt-free and making her way through college largely on her own. Rebecca Boyle is 21 years old. She's a senior finance major at the University of North Texas. She also works as a peer mentor at UNT's Student Money Management Center, where she makes $11 an hour. Rebecca, welcome. You are getting through college debt-free. I know you do have some fellowship money, but are your parents helping you out?
My parents have paid my cell phone bill and I'm on their health insurance, but all of my rent, utilities, food, and everything are covered from my scholarship money and from working.
How did you do that?
The big thing was that when I was looking at colleges, my mom had one rule for me. She said, you can go anywhere in the country you want to go as long as you can do it debt-free. And, you know, she probably thought that that would keep me close to home since my grandparents did have some money saved up in order to help me out. But I found the University of North Texas's program, and they had the largest scholarship I was eligible for in the country. So it just seemed to make sense to move to Texas and have the opportunity to go to college debt-free.
So you made the choice yourself from a very early age because your mom proposed this to you and you listened to her. Now, we were just speaking with another young woman who is struggling with debt, who said her grandparents who raised her never spoke with her about money at all. But your parents, it sounds like they did speak with you.
Right. So from the time that me and I have a younger sister, from the time that we were very young, they would give us an allowance every 2 weeks based on, I think we got 50 cents for every year old we were. And they would be very intentional in saying, all right, here's your money. We need one piggy bank where 10% goes to savings, one piggy bank where 10% goes to giving, and then the rest of it you can spend however you want. So from the time I was probably less than 10, they had started to ingrain in me the habits of, all right, when you get money, some of it's for saving and some of it's for spending. But as I got older, my mom was also a very big fan of Dave Ramsey. So every time I was in the car with my mom, Dave Ramsey was always on the radio. So it was just kind of always there, present in my life. And that actually got me really interested in it on my own, too. Hearing those stories and seeing that the impact of having debt versus not having debt has in people's lives got me to have a bit more of an intrinsic interest in it. That got even bigger. Somewhere in college, I stumbled upon like early retirement blogs too, that just gave me a sense of how much is possible beyond just, you know, getting by every month or beyond saving 15% of your income so one day you could retire. There was this whole group of people that was saying, all right, why don't we save half of our income and then be done at 30 or 40 instead of 70.
It sounds like you're referring to the FIRE movement, which stands for Financial Yes. Independence Retire Early. We've reported on it on this program. When do you plan to retire?
I'm not sure entirely. At first, when I first stumbled upon those, I was like, yes, I'm doing it. I'm going to be out at 30. But now thinking about it, it's not so much for me about, all right, I want to be able to retire and never have to work again. But I would like to be at the point, maybe 10 years out of school, where I can either quit and start my own business or move to a lower paying job that is more something that I enjoy versus something that's going to make me a lot of money. So I don't see myself retiring super young, but I do want to have savings habits that will let me have the freedom in life to do the work that I want and not do the work that I need to do to pay the bills.
Okay, I'm going to ask you a personal question. You're 21 years old. What kind of savings do you have?
I have about $5,000 in a retirement account. I think I have like $4,000 in my checking right now. And maybe, I'm not sure exactly what's in my savings account, but somewhere probably in the $10,000 to $15,000 range.
Wow. You're off to a good start. Do you put money in the stock market?
Yeah. So all of my retirement account is invested in the stock market.
Wow. And you're stitching this together because you make $11 an hour at the Financial Readiness Center at your school. You're just like socking away penny after penny. Do you splurge on anything? Like, do you have a weakness?
I do splurge sometimes. I have kind of an unwritten rule for myself where it's okay to splurge on things that are going to be one time, but nothing that's going to create a recurring expense.
Like if you go get a cup of coffee every morning. That's a no-no.
Right. So I could bear a nice pair of sunglasses once in a while, but I can't move to a fancier apartment.
Rebecca Boyle, a senior at the University of North Texas, telling us how it's done. Thank you very much and congratulations. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And you can tell us how you got your lessons about money growing up at hereandnow.org.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
A White House spokesperson said today that the Trump administration is not responsible for the death of a 7-year-old Guatemalan girl who died last week in Border Patrol custody. The girl was detained in a remote part of New Mexico with her father. The government says she died of dehydration and shock. She apparently hadn't eaten or had any water in days. Clara Long is a senior researcher for Human Rights Watch. And Clara, I think a reasonable question today is how on earth does a 7-year-old child die in federal custody?
Unfortunately, when I saw the news last night that this happened, my heart sank, but I'm not at all surprised. Children are moving through a network of border jails where we and others have documented for years dangerous conditions, including, you know, lack of access to food, to adequate water, and to medical care. And so, the fact that she's entering custody and then having a health crisis 8 hours later without potentially getting attention in that time, unfortunately, just doesn't surprise me at all.
Well, what's supposed to happen when a child comes into custody crossing the border? I would assume someone is supposed to be there making sure that they have food and that they have water, and if there is a medical emergency, that it would be addressed in a timely manner.
Right. A lot of the standards around these things have been set out by a court case called Flores, which we've heard about a lot in recent months because it's also regulated the amount of time that families can be held in custody. And that's something the Trump administration really wants to change. But unfortunately, even if there are these standards, and the standards are actually quite minimal, you know, in terms of extra snacks for children, adequate food, the lawyers in Flores have told the court again and again and again that the Border Patrol does not even abide to those minimal standards.
Hmm. On Tuesday, the Customs and Border Protection Commissioner, Kevin McAleen, testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee, and he was describing how large groups of families are now crossing the border. Let's listen.
Our infrastructure is incompatible with this reality. Our Border Patrol stations and ports of entry were built to handle mostly male single adults in custody, not families or children.
Is that something that investigators should be looking at? That the government, even though it's supposed to, by law, provide a safe environment for people in their custody, that the government's not able to do that right now?
Absolutely. If those Border Patrol cells are incompatible for the humanitarian reality of the border, then the U.S. should be doing something else. Many of the people who are crossing the southern border are people who are entering the U.S. to seek asylum. And the U.S.'s border control mechanisms treat them essentially all as criminals, including children.
The issue is there's a lot of them. This child came as part of a group of 163 people. So the government does have a challenge on its hand dealing with these large groups of families that are coming across the border, not to absolve them of responsibility, but it's not as if this is an easy problem to solve.
Certainly, it's a challenge. And, you know, there are many countries all over the world that are dealing with large numbers of forced migrants, asylum seekers, and are having to deal with even larger numbers. For example, people fleeing Venezuela right now into Brazil and into Colombia, countries that may have even fewer resources to throw at this challenge. But if other countries are figuring out how to do this in a way that treats families and children and asylum seekers with minimal dignity, then the U.S. can too.
Clara Long is a senior researcher at Human Rights Watch. Clara, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, let's take a break from the news now for a special video game music edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions. Kate Remington is music director at WSHU Public Radio in Fairfield, Connecticut. Her podcast is Music Respawn. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Jeremy. It's great to be here.
It's good to have you. And first of all, you're in Fairfield, Connecticut, which I don't associate more with video games than any other place. But what brings us to this?
Oh, a lot of things. I've been playing games for a really long time. And the more I play, the more I've been noticing the music. And so about 3 years ago, I had this idea to start a podcast talking with game composers because they often don't have a forum to talk about the amazing work they do. Mm-hmm. And the really fabulous thing is that I just reached out to Mike Salvatore, whose music I had really admired for Destiny. He also worked on the music for Halo and going back even further, the music for Myth. And I asked him if I could interview him for this fledgling podcast. And to my surprise, he said yes. So that kind of got the whole thing going. Mm-hmm. And one thing would lead to another. And I get referrals. And, oh, you should talk to this person. And so eventually, you know, word got out. And
now you're the expert in game music.
Well, one of them.
Okay.
One of them, yeah.
Well, let's get to some of the music that you brought us. This is Lost Light featuring the Kronos Quartet. This is from the game Destiny 2. So, in this game, it's a shooter game against an alien race, which I don't associate with this music, but tell us more.
Well, Destiny is this online game that has grown over the years, and what happens in Destiny 2 is the safe place that you always come to meet your friends and make trades and upgrade things is suddenly blown to smithereens. And not only that, the thing that keeps you alive, the thing that keeps you able to respawn is your light, and it's taken away. And so this is a really, really gripping emotional moment for players like me who've been with the game since the beginning. And Sky Lewin, who had the idea for this track along with Mike Salvatore, had to really argue with the studio that this would be the best music to have at that particular moment. And I think it makes the game just so powerful at that moment, because it just whittles down this massive world to a really intimate moment. And the Kronos Quartet were just absolutely thrilled to be part of this.
Really?
They were so excited. Oh yeah, they put together their own playlist, kind of riffing on the music that they wrote for Destiny. They were in on another track too. But I think it shows how the silos between classical music and game music, they really don't exist anymore, which I think is really cool.
Okay, well, the next one that you want us to hear is the theme song for Tomb Raider. This was written by Nathan McCree and performed by the Royal Philharmonic. Like a movie soundtrack, but I wonder, why do you think that classical music works so well in video games?
Well, for this one in particular, Nathan said that Lara Croft is such a classy character, and he wanted something that had a kind of an English feel to it, to sort of play up her classy side, I guess. Game music works in a similar way to film, in that it reinforces whatever the emotion is. And the composers that I talk with work very, very hard to make sure that the music fits with the game. And sometimes it's a long process. Sometimes they're working on the music for years before a game is finally published. But I think because we're used to listening to classical music in a film, it's kind of a natural progression for them to use it in games as well. Although, as we'll hear with a couple of the other tracks, it's not always sort of classical sounding.
Okay, and let's get to another track that you brought us. This is Gwarpati Solway. This is by Jason Graves. It's from the game Far Cry Primal. This is a game where you're a Paleolithic hunter and you tame animals. Here it is. This sounds like a video game to me, but is it true that Graves made this music using only rocks and drums and a ram's horn?
And dirt.
He had dirt too. Okay.
Yeah, and he used animal heartbeats. He's got quite a collection of animals, and he brought them into the studio and recorded their heartbeats.
Wow.
And he wanted something that didn't sound electronic at all, and as primal as the game is. And the developers, Ubisoft in Montreal, also found out about this thing called an Aztec death whistle. And Jason sort of took that and ran with it. So again, you know, it just like really reinforces what's going on as you're playing.
And why are the video game companies willing to spend this much money on this?
Well,
because you don't think of the music as the key part of the game. You got to have a really great game, and then the music I would think of as secondary, but maybe not.
Well, that used to be the case, and a lot of times the composers were brought in when the game was basically finished and then asked to write music for what there was. But the games industry now has grown so much. I mean, the game industry has a bigger share of the entertainment pie than any other media. And AAA games like Far Cry Primal have a huge music budget. And what the developers want is a completely unique sound that will instantly identify for players or even listeners, wow, that, you know, that doesn't sound like anything else. That sounds like Far Cry Primal.
The next one you brought us is called Clouds and Starlight. It's by Jessica Curry, performed by London Voices. This is from the game Everybody's Gone to the Rapture. It's a mystery game where the players work out why everyone in a small English town has disappeared.
Thank you.
Now, Jessica Curry won Best Music at the British Academy Game Awards in 2016. Tell us more about this one.
This one is spectacular. I've played it during my classical music show, and I love doing that because you can't tell that it's from a game. It almost sounds like if Elgar was writing music for games, this is what it would sound like. And to Jess's surprise, this soundtrack has actually led to some commissions for concert works from choral societies and choruses around the United Kingdom. So it just shows, again, this sort of, you know, breaking down the barriers between game music and classical music.
Well, when I think of video game music, and this is obviously going to be very old school after what we've just heard, this is what comes to my mind. Here it is. Okay, now do you know what that is?
Well, I'm going to guess it's from a Nintendo game.
Yes, it's from a Nintendo game. Any more?
Oh, probably a Mario game.
It's a Mario game. Yeah. It's Super Mario 3.
Mm, wow.
Yes. Yeah, long time ago. but that's what I think of. Yeah. But
the cool thing is there are composers now, Lena Raine comes to mind, and Disaster Piece, who have gone back to write music with 8-bit and 16-bit sounds. Mm. And it's so subtle and so wonderful. It's sort of like the best of both worlds. You know, it brings back memories, but it also sounds really fresh and new.
That is Kate Remington, a music director at WSHU Public Radio in Fairfield, Connecticut. Her podcast is called Music Respawn. Very interesting, Kate. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Jeremy.
More than 2 million people are employed as home healthcare workers in the United States. It's one of the country's fastest growing sectors, but many of those positions are going unfilled, and too many of those who are willing to do this work end up quitting. The worker shortage is adding up to a crisis. Amy Costello with the Nonprofit Quarterly reports.
Good morning.
How are you?
I am Stacy from Cooperative Care.
Oh, yeah?
Yep.
Stacy Hodge has been a home health care worker for 3 years.
Do you need help getting dressed or anything?
Oh, it's nice to do if you can get help with someone. I think I should get dressed. I've been debating all morning.
Have you?
Stacy is here to care for a woman who is more than 100 years old and still lives alone in her neatly kept home in rural Wisconsin. Stacy helps her get dressed, and then they head to the kitchen table, where the woman begins thumbing through an assortment of pills.
That red one is for a nighttime.
And this one looks like a green one, almost.
Is it a green one?
No. I guess it's just a tad bit different.
Stacy says she is not permitted to dispense medication, but you can hear the compassion and genuine concern in her voice.
It can be emotionally hard, you know, seeing somebody decline or even pass. But all in all, I love what I do. I love helping people. I think it's very rewarding.
But not financially rewarding. Stacy is a single mom with 3 kids. She makes $10.75 an hour, plus a little extra for gas and travel time. Stacy has one word to explain how she gets by.
Budget. As long as I stick to a budget, I do fine.
Stacy, in a couple of key ways, though, is exceptional. First, she's been a home care worker for 3 years. National figures show that more than half of her colleagues in any given year would have quit by now. According to Data USA, female home care workers here in Washera County, Wisconsin, make about $30,000 a year. For Stacy, that's close to the poverty line. And since the pay is low and the stress is high, the turnover rate in home care hovers around 65% annually. Robert Espinoza is the vice president of policy at PHI, a think tank that works to improve care for the old and disabled.
They often sometimes leave for other industries like fast food or retail that might offer them both higher wages and more flexible schedules.
Stacy receives no health care benefits, which is pretty typical in the home care sector, but she hears the gas station in town does offer them. Better job options are out there.
Some days I think, oh, it'd be nice, especially with health insurance, but for right now, I would rather make a little less and enjoy what I do.
If workers like Stacy are going to stick with their jobs, experts say the home care sector will have to make some big fixes. First, address the high turnover rate. David Hammer is executive director of the ICA Group, a consulting firm that advises home care companies. He says the sector has to figure out how to build better, lasting relationships between caregivers and clients.
And the way you do that is have consistency. So when you have reduced turnover, when you have people who are sort of staying at the company for a long time, it has a sort of a significant impact in the quality of care that you're delivering.
Another looming negative, immigration. Despite the growing demand for caregivers, White House policies threaten to cut the supply. Espinoza says 1 in 4 direct care workers are immigrants.
It's impossible to imagine that the long-term care system would function today without immigrants playing a significant role.
And there's something else contributing to the worker shortage. Many home health care workers are not working all the hours available to them.
We do have hours, our workers that cut their hours.
That's Tracy Dudinsky. Today, she's the Human Resources Coordinator of Cooperative Care, a home health care provider serving parts of rural Wisconsin. But back when her kids were young and Dudinsky was working as a home care worker, she turned down hours so she could keep state-sponsored health insurance for her family. 52% of home care workers in the U.S. receive some form of public assistance.
They want you to stay poor. Sometimes that's what it feels like. I mean, I've been there. With 3 diabetics in your family, you can't lose the state insurance. So you cut your hours and live not so cool.
As I followed Stacy around on her shift, she called Cooperative Care a couple of times to share her concerns about clients.
Hi, this is Stacy Hodge calling. She has a very, very small open area on her left leg. The nurse was here and had a Band-Aid on it. She thinks a dog scratched her, but it's very small.
But these small things can turn big if not addressed and lead to more expensive treatments in ERs, hospitals, and assisted living facilities. Home care workers help avoid these costs, so advocates argue they should be paid more given the cost savings they bring to the entire system. As is, agencies say they can't afford to offer better pay, health benefits, and training. So Cooperative Care's finance coordinator and board member Deborah Schultz says they're having trouble finding new workers. And she's worried about what that could mean.
It's a strong thing to say, but I fear we'll see death by neglect. There's just not going to be the workforce to help these baby boomers, to help them, you know, survive in their home and have a bath, just basic common things. If there's not enough people to do the work, they'll just, what's going to happen? It's very scary, very scary.
For Here and Now, I'm Amy Costello.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.